is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, April 27th of 2023. I'm your host, Alyssa Palazzo. Coming up on today's program, we'll check in on water levels along the Colorado River. Then, Radio Nibbles will provide tips on tipping. A BBC News update is at the bottom of the hour. Then, it's a public affair with Tish Buford. She'll be speaking with Aaron Massey of Justice Engaged Students of Colorado. Coming up at 9 is the April edition of the Radio Book Club. Today we'll hear from Colorado author Shelley Reed about her first novel, Go as a River, a love story set against the backdrop of a western slope town that was submerged by the creation of the Blue Mesa Reservoir in the 1960s. Then at 9:30, Cameron Henderson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first, a look at the headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Three high school seniors arrested in connection with a series of rock-throwing incidents will appear in court this morning. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office announced Wednesday that the suspects had been taken into custody without bond. One of the rock-throwing incidents resulted in the death of 20-year-old Alexa Bartell. A large landscaping rock smashed through her windshield and caused her car to crash. Six other drivers in Jefferson and Boulder County reported similar attacks that happened last week after dark over a period of about 3 hours. Of the remaining victims, two were injured, while four others reported damage to their vehicles. In a press conference Wednesday, Sheriff's Office spokesperson Jackie Kelly said investigators followed tips from community members and used cell phone device forensics to find the three young men. The teens were arrested at their separate homes in Arvada on Tuesday night. Kelly said they were friends who each attended different high schools. Colorado is on its way to rolling out universal preschool. KGNU's Eli Kalin reports.
Families submitted their top five preschool preferences in January. This week, about 25,000 of those families were matched with one preschool in their top five. Families that decline their match must submit new program choices for the next round of matching. Governor Jared Polis said universal preschool will help save parents and families an average of $6,000 per year. Families have until May 10th to accept or decline their match by logging into upk.colorado.gov. For KGNU, this is Eli Kalin.
Jurors found Jeremy Webster, the man charged with fatally shooting 13-year-old Vaughn Bigelow during a road rage incident, guilty of first-degree murder on Wednesday. On June 14, 2018, Webster drove after Megan Bigelow to the parking lot of her children's dentist office. After a confrontation, Bigelow testified that Webster shot her, her son Vaughn, and her 7-year-old son Asa. Webster also wounded John Gale, a witness who was in the parking lot. Webster had pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. His attorney told jurors he had schizoaffective bipolar disorder. But a court psychologist testified last week that Webster was sane at the time of the shootings. On Wednesday, Megan Bigelow told the court that the verdict gave closure to the case, but would never bring her son back. Webster was sentenced to life without parole for the murder charge and over 300 years for additional charges. The police officer who assaulted and tased Kenneth Espinoza in Trinidad last year has a 30-year history of violence, says Espinoza's attorney. KGNU's Jimmy Searfoss reports.
Attorneys say Lieutenant Henry Trujillo was forced to resign from the Las Animas County Sheriff's Office in 2009 following a sealed criminal conviction. According to official records, Trujillo's criminal activity went as far back as 1997 when he received a felony charge for menacing with a weapon. Other charges over the years included harassment, fighting in public, and disorderly conduct. Lieutenant Trujillo even appeared to have initiated a high-speed chase with his paraplegic brother, Richard Trujillo, whom he had pulled over for making an offensive hand gesture. As a result of Lieutenant Trujillo's rough handcuffing, his brother later needed shoulder surgery. Espinoza's attorney says Lieutenant Trujillo was never disciplined and alleged that the Sheriff's Department's actions are either incompetent or criminal. For KGNU, I'm Jimmy Searfoss.
The Denver City Council will partner with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to restore water ecosystems along the South Platte River. According to Denverite, the council approved a plan Monday to use $350 million towards the project that came from the federal bipartisan Infrastructure Law and Water Resource Development Act. The restoration project will focus on a 6.5-mile stretch of the South Platte, roughly from 6th Avenue to 58th Avenue. Officials estimate that the project will take about 10 years. A former hygiene fire department captain was arrested Wednesday on suspicion of multiple sex charges. According to the Daily Camera, four women have accused 30-year-old Cameron Barnaby of sexual assault or unlawful sexual contact. Two of the women were subordinates when Barnaby was a hygiene fire captain. They alleged that while on duty, he sent them sexually harassing messages. An affidavit states that Barnaby was allowed to resign from his post after an investigation into an inappropriate relationship. This allowed him to avoid being fired. Barnaby is now working for the Mountain View Fire Protection District, but has been placed on unpaid leave. Barnaby will be formally charged on Friday. Partly sunny today with a chance of afternoon thunderstorms turning into snow overnight, wind gusts up to 34 miles per hour in some areas. In Boulder, a high near 66 and a low around 32. In Denver and Fort Collins, a high near 68 and a low around 34. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
Listening to the Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Alyssa Palazzo. When we look up at the snowy peaks of the Rocky Mountains, what we're seeing is the future of water in western states. Tens of millions of people rely on the water that flows into the Colorado River from the Rocky Mountains snowpack. In the last 20 years, tensions over dwindling Colorado River water have been rising in step with climate change and global temperatures. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Dr. Jack Schmidt, the director of the Center of Colorado River Studies at Utah State University, about what a shrinking Colorado River means for everyone and everything it sustains.
So, Dr. Schmidt, I want to start with the 1922 Colorado River Compact, which basically divvied up water rights to all the water that was flowing through the Colorado River. And now in 2023, a lot of people and a lot of parties think that this compact is not fair and that they should change it. Tell me about what they're arguing over and what the problem is.
Yeah, so let's just think about the river first. The Colorado River has, for more than a century, been referred to as America's Nile. Similar to the Nile, the Colorado River's water was first used to sustain irrigated agriculture in the earliest 20th century. Today, 40 million people use the Colorado River. So the problem is that the natural runoff of the system has declined. But the river's already overtapped. And for 20 years of the 21st century, for everything of the 21st century, we kept using more water than was the declining supply. How in the world do you spend more than your income? You drain your checking account. How did we drain the checking account? We drained the reservoirs. So for 20 years, we kept spending like our income was the old days, but it wasn't. Now we have a system completely drained. So the modern argument is, well, I guess we better stop using as much because now we got nothing left in the bank account. And so everybody agrees on that, but everybody looks at the other guy and says, yeah, we got a problem and you need to cut. We got a problem and you need to cut. California uses, on average, as much water as the entire upper basin. So everybody else looks at California and say, you guys use the most, you need to cut the most. California says, are you out of your mind? We're one of the largest economies on planet Earth. How does that make sense when you're just growing pasture grass and livestock seed? And then they also say, and by the way, we're a nation of laws. And we started using the water first, so we have rights to use it. And then other people said, well, you're not going to cut off supplies. And I think that if you listen to California, California would tell you, well, they actually have reduced water use quite a bit. They used to use 5.4 million acre feet in the year 2020, and now they use less than 4.4. I mean, there are legal reasons why they were forced to do that, but both sides look at the other guy and say, you need to make the cuts. And, you know, and that's where we're at.
So this idea of thinking about how people are using the water and whether or not they should have rights to it or not reminds me of the story I worked on years ago about Saudi Arabia using Colorado River water in Arizona. So Arizona had sold Saudi Arabia huge parcels of land so that they could farm that land and grow alfalfa, which then they shipped back to Saudi Arabia to feed their cattle for livestock. And they did this because Saudi Arabia had outlawed growing alfalfa because alfalfa is incredibly water intensive. And I bring this up because it seems like for a long time we have treated water like it is free. And I wonder if we've gotten to the point where we actually have to reassess the value of water, not just, you know, for our farms, but for our future.
I think that your question is a spot on question for where we need to move ultimately. We live right now in a world in which we're still pretty much stuck in the past. We're still stuck in the concept of prior appropriation, first in time, first in right and use, that has guided Western water since it was developed in California and in Colorado, you know, right? And so, and then we live in the concepts of the Colorado River Compact negotiated more, you know, a century ago, which basically said each basin gets a certain amount of water, each state gets a certain amount of water, and we're going to do whatever we want to within that state. And that's just the way it is. And we're just arguing about whether we get our water, you get your water. And your question suggests that does that make the most sense? And I would assert that in the long term of society, and I'm not sure whether it's now or 10 years from now or 50 years, we can't keep going that way. We have to ask what uses of water provide the most important economic return. Which uses of water make the United States as a country the strongest and healthiest that it can be? Which crops make the most sense to grow in the upper basin or make the most sense to grow in the lower basin? Who can deny that we ought to be growing lettuce in December where it can grow? But maybe it doesn't make sense to be growing alfalfa when it's 120 degrees in July in the same place. Similarly, what we do with alfalfa and pasture grass is a significant and important question. And maybe we ought to be thinking about supplying dairies more importantly than supplying, you know, where we have cattle grazing. But those sort of concepts attack the most fundamental premises of American freedom and the independence of the American farmer and rancher, and imply a top-down level of control that I guess I would say that is the question, but we won't go near it. It all makes sense to me, but I don't think we're prepared to ask that question as an American society, even though I think those questions are inevitably the questions we need to ask.
Dr. Jack Schmidt is the director of the Center of Colorado River Studies at Utah State University. For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
How much should you really tip when you dine out? What's fair? On today's Radio Nibbles, John Lendorf and Kate Januska, author at Boulder Weekly, talk about tipping, a living wage, and Boulder restaurants. Good morning.
Good morning, and welcome out there in KGNU world, around the gigantic kitchen table here at KGNU. And this morning we're talking about a really touchy subject. Mm-hmm. Should you tip? Why do you have to tip? And what does that mean to the people who are actually working in restaurants and all that stuff? Kate, you recently wrote a story looking into the whole question of tipping and a living wage in light of labor issues and rising food costs and everything else. So remind people about the story.
Well, thanks for having me today, by the way. But yeah, I wrote a story for Boulder Weekly's Feast publication about tipping post-COVID. With all that's gone on in terms of the labor market, inflation, as you've said, or the restaurants closing for an extended period changed things as well. When restaurants came back afterward, a lot of them used it as a reset on their tipping policies. So yes, we have been noticing a difference as customers. And a lot of it does have to do with a living wage and making things fair.
Explain what that... people don't always look at their bill, you know. They see the bottom line. But if you look at the... On a lot of restaurant tickets, you'll see... It'll say living wage or back of house or what? Explain what that, what why that is.
Yeah, traditionally there would be the tip line alone after the cost of the meal, and that would be up for the customer to decide. But lately, there has been more massaging of the guest check, as you will, to perhaps give more tips to the back of the house rather than just the front of the house, the server keeping the tips. Other places are now doing house tips pooled, meaning that the amount you tip doesn't go just to your server, but goes into a pool that's divided by merit among the entire staff. What restaurants are really trying to do here is even out the differences between the front of the house and the back of the house.
And I spent my entire career in restaurants in the back of the house. Mm. That's the dirty, hot, noisy... difficult part of a restaurant. So, and I'd see these waiters and waitresses making vast amounts of money, and the cooks not so much. And so it became very hard to even hire cooks.
Indeed. And I worked the front of the house when I was younger, because it is kind of, in my opinion, a young person's game. The salary can be very variable, which as an adult is hard to deal with. So yes, it looks like the front of the house is taking a lot of cash over the table. But what a lot of people don't understand is that servers are one of the very few industries that have a tipped minimum wage rather than a minimum wage. So nationally, that hasn't risen since 1996. You get $2.13 an hour plus tips nationally. Now in Colorado, that is higher. You get $7.25 an hour. Plus tips, which obviously the tips are doing a lot of work there. Now, the back of the house may get more hourly, but it may not add up to the same amounts. And herein you see the complexities, is that both sides of the house contribute to the dining experience, and yet they're paid in different ways, appreciated in different ways, judged in different ways. And some of these new policies you'll see on the tip line are trying to even those things out or just make them more transparent.
Let's talk about some of the specific people that you talk to. For instance, you talked to Lisa Balcom at Faro Restaurant in Niwot. Tell me a little bit about what she said about the whole tipping living wage thing.
Oh, well, it was fascinating. They were very, very thoughtful when they opened up after COVID. And they decided that they were doing a... tip line, no tip line, just a complete 20 a percentage tip on the bill. So diners do not have to think about how much they want to do. They make sure that all of their customers are paying a flat fee, no need to think about tips, and they're giving their employees a great wage. She made the awesome point of there's no other industry where the boss doesn't get to decide the take-home pay of the employees. She's the one who trains them. She's the one who makes sure that they stick around, that they do a great job. And she would like to make sure that they make a living wage. And when put in those terms, it really does make sense. What other industry do you get to decide who, how much money as a salary the person that was working for you takes home?
Well, I noticed when I went to Staples, I didn't tip the person at the counter.
Right.
I didn't, when I went to, the grocery store, somebody helps me find a product. I don't hand them a $10 bill.
Right. And do you think that more restaurants will try to shift towards that? Do you think that tipping as a percentage will kind of, we're shifting away from that? Or do you think that that is just, not really a reality that we're going to be seeing?
I don't think tipping as a percentage is going anywhere. As Farrell pointed out, if one restaurant or two restaurants put the entire tip into the cost on the menu, suddenly they look incredibly overpriced and you can't shop restaurants. But what Farrell is doing, they're keeping the price on the menu and then adding that afterwards so you can still look at the menu and compare costs. So I don't think the percentage is going anywhere.
The problem, the way that chefs have put it to me, and we should note that there were a bunch of restaurants that Kate approached and people I've talked to who actually treat their employees very well, but they did not want to be quoted or talk about this on the record because it's a very touchy thing. And what they say to me is, are you willing to pay $30 for a cheeseburger? If every menu item accurately reflected all the costs and everything, would you pay it? But that doesn't seem right either.
Now, I spoke to The Sink, speaking of hamburgers. They have three owners. But one of the owners said to me, one of the reasons it's hard to discuss is because talking about pooling tips from the front of the house takes money from the servers to the back of the house. So it's always a little bit of a balancing act. Someone's always a little unhappy. But he also made the great point of, if you're planning on tipping 20%, which is standard for good service, if it's great service, tip more. If you're planning on tipping 20% and they add that 20% automatically at the end, you're still paying the same amount. So it's still a $30 burger. It's just you saw the 20-something price on the menu and you're paying the 30 after you add the tip. So it's really just psychological math.
Yeah. So what does this mean for patrons? How should they go about tipping, or what should we look for?
My advice is if you can't tip properly, don't go out to eat.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But for the restaurants, this is really going to be an ongoing challenge.
Yeah.
I would suggest just maybe shift your perspective a little bit, too, is that think of it as any other job.
Yeah.
At Staples, they earn salary and you don't tip. Maybe just start to think about servers in a new way.
Gotcha. And shifting gears a little bit, John, what is your most recent story about food?
Normally I talk about my column, but today the fabulous Best of Boulder Awards comes out in the Boulder Weekly. And there's dozens and dozens of food categories. Being the food editor, I, of course, wrote half of the blurbs. I won't ruin the surprise when you pick it up or read it online. But see if you can tell which ones I wrote. That's your quiz, but that's in today's, and this is a chance to maybe find some new restaurants that you want to patronize.
Well, wonderful. And what's the best thing you've tasted lately?
I'm going to give this one. Well, we'll do this one together, Kate.
Well, not a new one, but an old favorite is I went to date night at Ras Casa. Absolutely love the new location, the staff. It's still an amazing experience. Everybody go out there.
And, you don't have to use utensils.
No, use your fingers.
That sounds fun and enjoyable.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Well, you can listen to podcasts of previous Radio Nibbles at news.kgnu.org. Thanks, Kate. All right. And John?
Thank you.
And I hope everyone will join us next Thursday. Of course, We'll have radio nibbles, but that will immediately be followed by the fabulous Kitchen Table Talk with my co-host, Chef Dan Asher. And our special guests, it's an hour. We take calls. And so I hope you tune in for that next Thursday.
Yeah, be sure to tune in. That's all the time we have today for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Alyssa Palazzo. Special thanks to Shannon Young, Benita Lee, Eli Kalin, Jimmy Searfoss, Alexis Kenyon, and Radio Nibbles host John Lendorf, with special guest Kate Januska, for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for A Public Affair with Tish Buford. That's coming up on the other side of these BBC News headlines.